Hey, it's Mark. Last week I let you know that the dates have been set for the next Crosscut Festival. It's happening May 1st and 2nd, 2020. And I asked you to let us know what we should talk about and who we should invite. You've sent in some great ideas, thank you. But we need more. So if you haven't yet, go to crosscut.com/festival and give us your suggestions. Okay, on with the show. Hello and welcome to Crosscut Talks, a podcast replay of Crosscut's live interviews with the people who shape our world. I'm Mark Bumgarten, the news and politics editor at Crosscut. The United States incarcerates more people per capita than any other country in the world. And a vastly disproportionate number of the people we lock up are people of color. A growing bipartisan movement wants reform. But how do we do that with an eye toward justice? Crosscut invited two authors with expertise in the fields of criminal justice and racial bias to discuss the many ways the system impacts some communities more than others, and what it will take to change that system. Jennifer Eberhardt is a professor of psychology at Stanford University and a recipient of the 2014 MacArthur Genius Grant. Her work often explores the psychological association between race and crime. Her new book, Biased, Uncovering the Hidden Prejudice That Shapes What We See, Think, and Do, was published in March 2019. Emily Bazelon is a staff writer at the New York Times Magazine and lecturer at Yale Law School. Her new book, Charged, The New Movement to Transform American Prosecution and End Mass Incarceration, explores how the unchecked power of prosecutors contributes to an imbalanced and unjust system, and how things are slowly changing. David Plotz is CEO of Atlas Obscura and host of Slate's Political Gabfest. He moderated the discussion. This conversation is sponsored by Comcast and Waldron. It was recorded on May 4th, 2019 at Seattle University as part of the Crosscut Festival.
Hello.
Hello.
We can't see you. Hopefully you can see us.
Yeah, we can't. See, just bright lights.
Yeah.
Thank you all for coming. So let's get started. You both have books. The first instruction is that everyone here should go buy these books, which are great. One is called Charge, the other is called Biased, which suggests a kind of similarity in title approach. I think you could do like Barged, could be a sequel you guys could write together.
That's a great idea. I'm ready to sell that right now.
So actually, I hate to do this, but why don't each of you spend a couple of minutes, starting with you, Jennifer, just telling the folks who have not read your books and don't know about it, what is the basic thesis of your book? What are you exploring? You do that, and then Emily, you do that for your book.
So my book is called Biased, Uncovering the Hidden Prejudice That Shapes What We See, Think, and Do. And it's really an exploration of unconscious bias, or what some people call implicit bias. And it's looking at, how that bias, like sort of what produces it and how it affects us in lots of different contexts. So I look at the criminal justice system, for example. I look at how it can shape who we see as suspicious in neighborhoods. I look at how it can affect how teachers discipline their students in schools, and I look at the workplace and how it can affect us there and so forth. And so it's really a deep dive on racial bias in particular, although, to some extent, this bias is something that affects all social groups. But I wanted to do a deeper dive on racial bias, just given sort of focus of issues of race right now in our country, and just people seem to be sort of grappling with these issues. And I wanted to add science to that discussion and have a belief that science can help us as we think through these things, and to help us figure out how we got here and how we can get out of it.
I just wanted to say I've been reading Jennifer's works for years and been tremendously influenced by it. It really, once you start thinking through the lens of the experiments she's done and the kind of thinking she's done, it's you see it all the time around you, I think. My book is called Charged. It's about the power of prosecutors. And I'm making an argument that prosecutors in the last 40 years have amassed much more power than our system was designed for. For a couple of different reasons. And then that's really distorted how the criminal justice system works. It's moved prosecutors into a kind of key decision-making role at charging and plea bargaining in a way that judges used to have at trials. Judges, of course, are meant to be the neutral referees in our system. Prosecutors are not neutral. They have an obligation to do justice, but they also try to win convictions. And so to hand over key decision-making authority to them is a real distortion of the model that we kind of imagine when we think of the American criminal justice system, and especially we think of trials and key parts of criminal procedure happening in open court. Those are really kind of vanished elements of our system. But I'm also arguing that at this moment in our history, as a very recent phenomenon, there's a window of opportunity to change how prosecutors exercise their power. They have been using it for decades to drive more and more people into jail and prison. But now we are having a real bipartisan interest in radically transforming the system and shrinking it down. And prosecutors are starting to get elected in a lot of major cities, including Seattle, who are offering, instead of a kind of tough on crime, law and order mantra, a set of principles that could make the system fairer and reduce mass incarceration. So I'm sort of looking at both kinds of prosecutorial power in my book.
Okay, now you know, now you can go buy the books afterwards. Okay, so Jennifer, give us one or two examples of specific examples of how unconscious bias affects how communities are policed and how you studied that and what conclusions you drew from that.
Okay, so unconscious bias can be defined as the beliefs and the feelings that we have about social groups that can influence our decision making and our actions, even when we're not aware of it. And so a lot of the studies that I do, I sort of put people in situations where they don't even know that they're, that we're actually focused on bias, and we're just having them react. And we might, change the race of the person that they see. So, for example, in some laboratory studies, we'll expose people to a series of black male faces or to a series of white male faces, and then we show them blurry images of weapons, of guns or knives, and we find that for those who had been exposed to these black male faces beforehand, they need less information before they could say, oh, I can pick that out as a gun or that's a knife. But if they've been exposed to white male faces beforehand, they need a lot more clarity. They need a lot more information. So that's one example. We have other studies where we've looked at this issue in a way that kind of connects to racial profiling. So in this study, we've exposed people to crime objects, say on a computer screen, to sort of get them to think about violent crime. And then we show them a black face and a white face on the screen simultaneously. We just look at where their eyes go. And we find that if they've been exposed to these crime objects, their eyes will move away from the white face and towards the black face. And you see this with police officers too, when we get them to think about, sort of arresting or capturing or shooting, that kind of thing. They will move their eyes towards the black face.
Have you done studies on police officers?
Yeah, so the last one I just described was with police officers.
And where did you do that, and how did you persuade a police department to go along with that?
So this was in sort of near Stanford, so it was in California. I think that the police departments are a little less, anxious or nervous about studies that have to do with the unconscious bias, because we're not, coming in sort of trying to, find blame in one person or to monitor the department in some way. There are no lawyers, involved with this. It's just scientists trying to understand how race might play a role in policing. And so they find that actually appealing because they understand that race does play a role. But typically, when you're trying to sort of think about how that all works, it's under the sort of threat of some federal oversight or some consent decree or something like that. And so the idea that you can come in as a scientist just to try to sort of improve things and improve police-community relations through the science, I think they're surprisingly open to that.
I wonder, too, if there's a practical reason for the police to be concerned about implicit bias. I mean, there are many, but one that occurs to me is that, so in studies in places like New York, you see that when the police are stopping and frisking a lot of people, they stop and frisk many more African Americans, right. But they are more likely to actually find weapons or contraband on white people. Right. And so they're actually misusing their resources in part, right? And this statistic just floored me. In New York, at the height of stop and frisk, 4 out of 5 of the young black men and teenagers in the city were being stopped. Like, that's just such a huge proportion.
Use your mic. I'm just saying that's all.
Sorry.
I'm sending hand signals to you, Jennifer. Because you were just saying things that we were off mic. That's all. Sorry, Emma.
David's trying to be helpful, and yet. Anyway, I just... it just seems like if we are going to keep having... I mean, it's not just law enforcement, but for law enforcement to be so affected by racial bias means that they're missing cues and then stopping the wrong people.
Right. And sometimes putting themselves in danger, right? Because they're actually less likely to, you know, see a gun in the hands of a white person than a black person, and so there's an issue there too of their own safety.
Well, can you also, Jennifer? We'll get to your book, Emily, eventually. Can you
telling me to put it down?
So can you also talk about specific ways that you have worked with police, or the ways that police departments are trying to grapple with this, and have what successful reforms are police departments making that may diminish this?
So Emily just mentioned the NYPD, and so I'm actually they're under federal oversight, and I'm on one of the members on that team, and one of the issues there. So it wasn't just that they were stopping more, you know, African Americans, but finding more on white Americans, but their hit rate was super low. So we were interested in looking at the role that race might play in what they call furtive movements, furtive movements is, well, actually, what is that?
Yeah,
this
what is
the question. So this was something that, this was a reason that you could stop someone as an officer on the streets of New York City, but they couldn't define what it was. So the department did not have an agreed upon definition of what furtive movements, what that meant. And so that left it to officers to determine, you know, what movement seems suspicious, and that might vary based on who it is and where they are in the city and so forth. So they ended up removing that from the form that officers have to complete when they make a stop. And so this was like a subjective metric, right? And so they want to use more objective metrics. And it turned out that furtive movement, it was by far the number one reason people were stopped in New York, and the racial disparities for furtive movement were especially high. So that was one reform, just removing a question, right? Removing what's considered a legitimate reason to make a stop.
I remember when we talked earlier, you also cited, I think it was at Oakland. Didn't Oakland, can you mention that example too? They added something?
Yes. So I also have been involved with the Oakland Police Department and their reform efforts for the last 5 years or so, and they were making, you know, quite like a large number of stops of people who weren't committing serious crime. And so we had a focus group basically, and we sat with them over time and tried to figure out how do you sort of track stops that seem most significant to the department. And those were stops that they called intel-led stops or intelligence-led stops. And what they mean by that is that these are stops where you can, you have credible information that would tie a specific person to a particular crime. And so they wanted to prioritize those kinds of stops. So that meant they had to start to measure those kinds of stops. And so we added to their form that they complete when they make a stop, is this stop intelligence-led or not, yes or no, basically a checkbox. And we found that officers, when you ask the simple question, right, they have to pause and think about, you know, do I really need to make this stop? Is this a high-priority stop? They start to think about all of the other stops they've made and think about sort of what percentage of them have been intel-led and so forth. So it caused a pause, and that pause led to a huge drop in the number of stops. So before the question was added to the form, they had about 32,000 stops across the city, and once it was added, it dropped to 19,000 stops. So it was a 40% reduction in stops simply by asking officers to kind of replace the hunches with actual, you know, information that they're thinking through before approaching someone.
So, Emily, let's turn to prosecutors. So, what are the kind of huge biases and distortions that have been injected into the criminal justice system because prosecutors have been granted so much power in the recent decades?
Yeah, so prosecutors started to get a lot more power in the 1980s when the country was responding to a rise in crime by increasing sentences and, first of all, adding to the sheer number of prosecutors. Their numbers almost doubled in the 80s and 90s. And then particularly by creating a category of mandatory minimum sentences. So once you have these mandatory minimums, the charge a prosecutor brings is going to determine the punishment, right? And we did that in part to eliminate discretion from the system, and actually discrimination. The idea was that judges had way too much leeway about the sentence to choose, that maybe it would be racially biased, that if you had this floor that was set, that would tie their hands. What we didn't think about was that you can't eliminate discretion from the criminal justice system. And so we instead moved it to the hands of prosecutors because they controlled the charging and they could use heavy charges to induce plea bargains. So you see the rate of trials going way, way down to something like 2 or 3% of convictions these days. And you see the charging and plea bargaining really controlled by prosecutors. And it turns out this is not a good way to reduce racial disparity because prosecutors, like judges, unfortunately, take similar behavior by white people and black people, and they punish, charge black people, offer worse plea bargain offers to black people.
Can you cite any stats on that, or is there evidence about that?
I don't have numbers that I have in my head for the degree, but it is certainly a finding that's been repeated over and over again. It also applies to the kinds of bail requests that prosecutors make and that judges grant. And bail is an important part of the story because if you go to jail before your trial because you can't afford bail, you're much more likely to plead guilty just to get out of jail.
Yeah, I believe the Vera Institute has done a study with the DA's office in Manhattan and found that there were pretty significant racial disparities, especially in terms of the charging, the plea bargaining, and so forth, and especially in terms of drug-related offenses. And they found it's interesting, all these DA's offices use kind of algorithms or, you know, for how it is that they're going to, like what the plea bargain is going to look like. The researchers found that that there was the arrest rate was part of that algorithm in addition to the, you know, prior convictions and so forth. And they found if they just removed the arrest rate, the racial disparities actually went away. But I think, you know, that arrest rate is in there for a lot of these DAs.
So elaborate on that. So people who had been arrested several times before, when they were getting charged, they would get charged with a more serious offense?
Yeah, well, if you're talking about risk assessment tools that are driven by algorithms, so prosecutors can use them to decide to charge. Often judges use them when they're deciding whether to grant bail or not. If you include someone's arrest record, you're just replicating all the racial discrimination we've been talking about, all those extra stop and frisks. They're all baked into that risk assessment. If you take arrests out, you have a lot less racial bias kind of in the results that the tool is spitting out.
And an arrest is not a conviction, right? So
right.
So that's why, you know, you might consider taking it out. And we know that arrests, too, you know, if you live in certain neighborhoods and so forth, that it's more likely simply because you're in that space and the police are in that space that and you could get pulled over and all of this.
So Emily, now moved again to the reform movement. So what has motivated the prosecutorial reform movement? What are the major changes that these reform prosecutors are bringing to prosecutors' offices around the country?
So the reform movement has bipartisan support. Increasingly, you do public opinion polls, and people say that they are interested in voting for candidates who want to shrink mass incarceration. It's true about the majority of Republican as well as Democratic voters. I think part of it is just the enormous cost. We're spending so many billions of dollars on a system. If you think about the return on investment, you might be concerned that 2 out of 3 people who go to jail and prison get out and then cycle back in. So what is the system really accomplishing? And then I think the Black Lives Matter movement has been a really important and powerful force here. You know, often Black Lives Matter groups start by protesting the actions of the police related to Jennifer's work. But then there's this question of like, well, what can we deliver that's really going to change our city and our community? And it turns out that local DA's races are fairly easy to have a big impact on. People historically haven't paid a lot of attention, and incumbents have just gotten reelected. But what we've learned since 2016 is if you put a reformer on the ballot who connects well to the people who are the most impacted by the system, especially communities of color, those voters will rally to that candidate and show up at the polls. And so what we've seen are people elected in cities like Philadelphia and Boston and Chicago and Brooklyn who are promising to make jail and prison the last resort instead of the sort of automatic default punishment. And that idea, along with declining to prosecute a lot of arrests that the police make for, you know, relatively low charges, that has been a really important shift. And then there's also this question of trying to hold law enforcement accountable. The police and prosecutors normally have been, and they mostly work as partners and are afraid to challenge each other. But when prosecutors don't in any way play a role in holding police accountable, then we have this kind of, you know, pattern of shootings of unarmed people where nobody gets indicted. So one of the things these reformer prosecutors are doing is promising to address that.
So Jennifer, as you've studied the police, you've been looking at unconscious bias. Do you think if the system successfully addressed most of the unconscious bias problems, that they would get rid of most of the problems in disproportionate policing and in bias in criminal justice? Or is unconscious bias a big or small piece of that?
It's one piece of it. I don't think if you got rid of unconscious bias that you get rid of disparities. I mean, those disparities are being driven by lots of different things. And in fact, sort of what disparity you focus on, you know, kind of depends on, you know, if you're a police officer or a community member oftentimes. And so you have disparities in the crime rate that police officers will focus on more and say, well, okay, I'm stopping people and arresting people and so forth because, and there are disparities there because there are disparities in who's committing the crime. But then if you ask lots of community members, when they think about disparity, they're in a criminal justice system, they're thinking about disparities in the actions of police officers. They're thinking about disparities in terms of, you know, stops and searches. And in Oakland, there's huge disparities in handcuffing. So you could get sort of pulled over for a minor traffic violation and you end up handcuffed on the side of the road. And we found actually in our analysis that 1 in 4 African-American men were handcuffed in these situations. So that's what they're focused on.
What would the rate be for for whites.
So it was 1 in 15 for white men. Wow. Yeah, so it was a big difference.
Where do Latinos fall in this? Do Latinos suffer from the same bias as African Americans, or in between?
Sometimes it was in between, but when we actually controlled for all the things you're supposed to control for, like non-racial factors,
nice
that could, what'd you say?
Good work, control. Yeah. Yeah, that's key. That's why you have tenure.
Yeah.
That's why you're at Stanford.
So when we took into account all these other issues, these non-racial factors, then those disparities for them went away. Largely. So the biggest disparities we saw and the ones that persisted were with African Americans.
Go ahead, Emily.
Well, I just want to pause on this idea of handcuffing so many more people. You know, you could sort of dismiss that as like a momentary occurrence, but I see over and over again in my reporting with people in the system that there are so many small moments that are humiliating and dehumanizing and that like don't happen to my white kids. And I just feel like it's important to remember how those small things add up and what they really mean to the people who experience them.
Yeah, for sure. We only looked at handcuffing because we did these sort of focus group meetings with community members, and it kept coming up over and over again. And so that was something that was important to them. And then when we actually looked at the form, you know, the data that they're collecting, handcuffing actually was on the form, and we hadn't even looked at it because it wasn't a typical thing to look at in this kind of analysis. But once we looked at it, it was like it was the largest racial disparities we saw were there. And they mentioned it because, yeah, it is. It's really humiliating. I don't know if people here have been handcuffed before, but it's humiliating, and it's very visible to just people on the street, and you're sort of standing there, as presumed criminal.
And do these biases also affect Black women in the same way they feel like Black men?
It was more severe for Black men. Yeah.
So this is a question for both of you. I think we've noticed in one dismal aspect of Republican politics recently has been the skepticism about science and about social science and about kind of evidence-based policy.
Right.
Is the work that you're doing, Jennifer, or the work that you're studying,
writing about,
Emily, do we have that partisan divide on these issues too, or is it a case where Democrats are willing to look at sort of studies and surveys and science scientific research, and Republicans aren't, or is it not that cut and dried?
Well, for me, with the work in Oakland, because it was a team of Stanford researchers, and we go there and we're working directly with them on the ground, and so I don't think, so the whole partisan thing, I don't know if that is as salient, because we're sort of, I mean, we're trying to, we have the same aims. And so for this Intel-led box, right, that we added, they were all like in big agreement about that, because they wanted to actually... to mark what it was that they were doing, and they felt without that the disparities are misunderstood. And so when we began to track that, not only did the number of Intel-led stops go up, right, which you want it to. You want those are the kinds of stops you want to prioritize. But the number of these sort of stops for minor traffic violations or these discretionary stops went way down. So that's where we got the plummeting effect that I mentioned before.
What I've noticed with regards to this question is a kind of attachment to certain unproven theories that it has to do with confirmation bias. So like the Ferguson effect, there was this sort of assumption that, well, you know, once Ferguson happened and Michael Brown was shot and there was this police became so afraid of backlash that they were not on the streets anymore.
They
and that's what
not shooting innocent people nearly
yeah,
as much.
Well, right. But that if the police pull back, that's what you blame for the spike in homicides in Chicago. And a kind of deep attachment to that theory in the face of other evidence without recognizing that these are like complicated phenomena. They're almost all multi-fact. It's not just one thing. I was looking recently at a couple of graphs. So you can see that after the ACLU sues the city of Chicago and the police indeed are told that some of their stop and frisks are illegal, you can see, yes, a rise in homicides. You can also see that the police have stopped solving homicides and shootings. There's this huge drop. And maybe that is part of why crime went up, because all these people who had committed murder or shootings were still out on the streets. And the kind of cherry picking of which explanatory factor you put out there politically, that's what I feel like is still really happening in this space.
But sometimes the theories are wrong, right? And you can show that they're wrong. And when that happens, I think that's where you get real change in terms of the narratives that people tell. So with this whole intel-led thing, for example, I mean, the number of stops went way down, even though the crime rate continued to go down. And so then the officers in the department had to, face the fact that actually they didn't need to stop that many people to fight crime. It wasn't the only way, to fight crime. And the same in New York, when
they ended stop and frisk.
Oh yeah,
they cut back on it. I shouldn't say they ended it.
Yeah, right. But there was huge outcry about that. Everyone was so worried that it was gonna, crime was gonna get out of control, and that you needed this, and this was a main mechanism for controlling crime, and without it, it's going to be terrible. And it didn't happen. So the stops are way, way down from what they used to be. And the crime rate did not go up like they predicted. And so now people are having to, face the fact that they were wrong, and to rethink whether all of this is necessary and whether people need to be treated in this way.
Part of what we're talking about is redefining safety, right? So if it turns out that you don't need to stop and frisk everyone to keep crime down, well, maybe you can reallocate those resources and solve more of the homicides and shootings. And isn't that the way that you can make the community safe? And then can we kind of look beyond law enforcement to think about how you make communities thrive? Which, you think about neighborhoods most people want to live in. They're places with good schools and access to jobs and good health services. We don't usually associate those aspects of our kind of social compact with preventing crime, but they're actually crucial.
Just a couple more questions before we get to Q&A. But Emily, you focus on reform prosecutors who are elected. They tend to be elected in big cities with liberal populations. Is this prosecutorial reform movement going to be limited by that fact? Will there be prosecutorial reform in places which are not liberal and where the prosecutors, the people running for those offices, aren't cut from the same group as Larry Krasner?
Who is the DA in Philadelphia? Look, I mean, there are ways in which big metropolitan areas with lots of Democratic voters are the low-hanging fruit of this movement, but it's not limited to those places. So, for example, Jacksonville, Florida is part of a district that's mostly white and mostly Republican. They have a reform prosecutor, Melissa Nelson. The city of Denver, the city of Boulder. There are places across the country in red and purple and blue states where this is happening. And there's sort of two ways to think about the numbers. So there are about 2,400 elected prosecutors in the country. That's a really big number. But if you took the 125 biggest metropolitan areas and you get those voters to elect progressive prosecutors, that affects criminal justice for half the American population because of the size of those places. And that feels like an attainable goal. It's not national, but you could also imagine those places being models that are safe and also better places to live where we're not sending everyone to prison. And then maybe you persuade some state legislators to enact statewide reform because they could see that it's safe and politically safe to take these kinds of stances.
In an ideal world, or in a better world, should this be on prosecutors to make these reforms, or would the system be better if, rather than us electing reform-minded prosecutors, state legislatures gave more power back to judges, more discretion back to judges, rolled back mandatory minimum sentences? Where should the reform happen? Should it happen with the elected prosecutors, or with this other way?
This is a second best way to go about this, right? I mean, it's relying on cities and local elected DAs to give up their discretion or use it differently is not the straight line that repealing mandatory sentences and reducing the size of the criminal code would be, but it looks a lot more promising right now, right? I mean, this is a way toward deeply needed reform that does not depend on fixing Washington or even fixing your state capital. So I'm a pragmatist and I kind of see that possibility and I see how hard these local community groups are working on the ground for this goal. And I take that really seriously. But if you were waving a magic wand, you would not go about it this way. And in the end, prosecutors need to give up some of their power as well as learn to use it differently.
Jennifer, going back to unconscious bias, so I think one thing you touched on earlier was you were saying it was, in a way, these studies were less threatening to police departments than some big federal oversight might be. But in another way, unconscious bias is very threatening to everyone because everyone is infected by it. And so how, I mean, there's this there's almost this notion in American life which is, where it's worse to call someone a racist these days than to their racist behavior is, that calling them a racist is worse than their actual racist behavior. Is there a danger with, I mean, danger is not the right word, but with unconscious bias, is there a problem, which is that when you show people how racist they are, that makes them defensive, it doesn't make them want to, they don't welcome that knowledge.
Well, I think if you take the sort of moral issue out of it, you don't have that reaction. And I think we have that reaction because we define bias as, bad actors. We define, the people who enact bias as bigots. And we imagine sort of burning crosses and people filled with hate, right? So that's what we imagine. And so when you call someone a racist, if that's what you're saying they are, then they're going to get defensive and they're going to feel threatened and they're going to shut down. They're not going to hear you. But with this unconscious bias, it doesn't require bad actors. I mean, you can have the best intentions, you can be motivated to be fair, but still you can behave in a way, that is infected by bias. And this is about, so when you bring the science to it, right, we can kind of understand why that is, but we also can understand, under what situations you're going to be more or less likely to have bias infect your decision making or infect your actions. And as social psychologists, I'm a social psychologist. We know a lot about what those conditions are, what those situations are that are going to trigger bias, and which ones will tamp it down.
And I think one thing you said to me earlier was that the unconscious bias, which police officers are demonstrating, is true of white cops and black cops.
Yeah. Yes. Yep.
Actually, before we're about to go to Q&A, but before we came on, Jennifer was telling us an amazing story from her own life, which is in the book, which I'm going to ask you to talk about, just about not being able to recognize people and about our ability to recognize people.
I set you up for this because I like this.
So this
story.
Has nothing. This still doesn't really have anything to do with what we're talking about, but
no,
it's a taste of why her book is going to be so good and why you should buy it.
So this is a story. This is a story of me as a kid. I was 12 years old, and I was growing up in Cleveland, Ohio. And Cleveland is, at least at that time, we were the fifth in the nation in terms of racial segregation. And so my neighborhood was all black, and everybody that I had ever really had meaningful interactions with, they were all African American. So my parents decided that we were going to move when I was 12 to an all-white suburb called Beechwood. And so I was thinking, oh boy, what is that going to be like? And so I was nervous about whether I would be accepted and, whether I'd be able to make friends and whether I would feel like I belong there. It was just like a foreign space to me. And so when I got there, it turned out that the students were super friendly. They were nice. They were welcoming. They wanted to show me all around the school and so forth. But I still had problems making friends. And that was because I could not tell their faces apart. I've like standing, and they all, I mean, they all looked alike, and I couldn't figure out, and I would be like, oh, I'd try to remember, well, this girl had on the red sweatshirt, and this one had on the gray sweater, but then they changed clothes, obviously, the next day. And
unreasonable.
And then I'd be like, are you my friend? You know? So I was just at a loss, and really, I was in a panic about it, because I felt like I had lost this basic skill where, you know, we all, you know, you should be able to identify people and to recognize faces, but I found myself just not able to do that anymore, and I didn't know how long it would last or why that was happening, but, you know, as a researcher many years later, it turns out that this is a pretty common thing. It's something that researchers have, you know, studied for decades, and it's called the other race effect. It's just that people are less able to recognize faces of other races than they are faces of their own race. And part of that has to do with our segregated spaces, right? That if we're, your brain is sort of practicing on faces, you know, that are, if you're living in segregated spaces, that are all like you, right? And so you learn this sort of fine-grained ability to really distinguish these faces in a way that you never do for faces that are outside your race. And so that's what I was experiencing in Beechwood. I hadn't practiced, but when I spent enough time in that space, slowly I was actually able to recognize those faces. So.
All right, we're going to go to Q&A. You guys have submitted a ton of great questions. We will only get to a small fraction of them. So let's start. Here's a question from Tyler, which is for both of you, actually. How does racial and prosecutorial bias vary worldwide? What are the general patterns and what are the idiosyncrasies of different regions or nations? If you know this, you may not. You may have focused on America.
Well, a lot of my work focuses on the U.S., but you know, categorization and stereotyping, those are sort of functions of the brain. So people, the researchers think about them as universal. So the content of the stereotypes might change across different cultures or different countries, and the actual social groups that you're thinking about and the disfavored groups, especially that you're thinking about, those might change from place to place. But the act of stereotyping and the act of categorizing of sorting people into social groups is something that's universal.
I will answer the question a little differently, which is to say that, you know, I think in the United States we often assume that our criminal justice system or many of our systems are better, that American exceptionalism is a great thing. In studying prosecutors, I've come to the opposite conclusion. The Europeans have a different system than ours in which there isn't, it's not adversarial so much as truth-seeking, and so prosecutors don't play the role of necessarily trying to win convictions. They're about trying to decide, to figure out what happened. And it's a much more kind of technocratic job, and it turns out that the Europeans, you know, don't have the same degree of trouble with wrongful convictions that we have in this country, and they are also just much less punitive, and they're not wasting resources and ruining lives the same way we are here. They really treat prisons as places that are supposed to prepare you to return to being a citizen and a productive member of the community. So this is one aspect of American exceptionalism that we might rethink.
Okay, here's a question from Liz. It's probably mostly for you, Emily. How should we judge former attorneys general like Kamala Harris, who have progressive legislative agendas, but had to form law and order partnerships with police as attorneys general?
So I have sort of two conflicting feelings about this. On the one hand, I think that, you know, Kamala Harris is someone who is not a progressive prosecutor by today's measures. When she was the DA in San Francisco, she did some things. She did some things as attorney general, like work with Jennifer, actually, that were good. But people have moved, the vanguard of this movement has moved far beyond where she was in office. And I think it's fine to look back at her record and consider it from that vantage point. I also think, though, it's really important to remember that when Harris got elected Attorney General, she was one of two African American women in the entire country elected statewide office. And part of how she got there was by presenting the kind of image of strength that comes from being a prosecutor. And I just want us to also factor that into how we evaluate her record.
I was just going to say, oh, there was applause.
I like that. worked with her a lot, so you might have thoughts.
Yeah, I've worked with her some. I mean, even at that time, though, she was not, you know, when a lot of people were, you know, tough on crime, she had this whole mission as Attorney General to be smart on crime. And so she was trying to bring the research to bear on these issues and to, you know, push policymakers to rethink things. And I remember she had these sessions when she first became Attorney General in California, where with law enforcement, with a lot of various groups. And so I was there as one of the academics with lots of chiefs from different, you know, cities around the state. And I just remember them, we were talking about you know, the crime rate going down, and that you know, the prison rate was going up, and they saw that as a win. They thought, oh, well, this means we're really doing our job, right?
Did she push back
so
on that?
She wasn't there at that particular meeting, but it just struck me that,
she's up against that culture.
Yeah. And I thought, wow, I mean, this is, and there was no contact at all with any of the research on this, or, but they were, you sort of saw themselves, you know, to a person as good actors in this whole system at that time.
Important to remember the context that she was operating in.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, question for you, Jennifer. This is a great question. We're not, most of us are not in one of your research studies, as far as we know. Maybe this is all, we're all being studied right now.
But it's always a possibility.
I said it's always a possibility.
So, but what is the best way for everyday citizens, for us to be cognizant of our own unconscious biases? And be allies to those who are falling victim to those biases.
I think the best way is to try to really understand what it is and how it works, and so to be sort of open to the body of research that has looked at this. And I think really understanding the situations or the conditions under which it gets triggered, because with that understanding comes a lot of power in terms of being able to protect yourself from it. So bias is something that we're all vulnerable to, but we're not always acting on it. So we don't act on it all the time. There's certain situations that are more likely to you know, to kind of bring it alive. And so that's what I would say. And I try to spell this out in the book, and biased in ways that are not just about the studies and the science, but also with real stories of people who have been hurt by this, who have had their lives upended. So I've, you know, talked to people from, I don't know if you remember Terrence Crutcher, the case of the person whose car stopped on the road in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and he was shot and killed by the police there. And
he was like running away from them, and his back was turned,
his hands were in the air. He wasn't running, he was actually walking really slowly, and he got to the car. They were worried he was going to get a weapon out of the car, and so the officer shot him and killed him there. And I talked to his twin sister. He had a twin sister, and you know, we spent, you know, a fair bit of time together, but it's you know, it was, I think, amazing, just, you know, in terms of a lot of times as scientists, we just are thinking about what's happening in the brain, and we're sort of interested sort of in the abstract way, you know, about how bias works and so forth. But to actually, you know, with the book, to sort of talk to people and to, you know, to try to lift up the voices of people who are affected, I think that's really important. And I don't think that, you know, that those people appear enough because we're just focused on, you know, bias as this sort of scientific kind of thing, and not on the pain and the harm from it.
All right, we have time for one more question, mostly for you, Emily. It's from Bethany. How do you anticipate recent bail reform measures are going to impact how racial disparities manifest in incarceration?
You know, I think bail reform has the potential to really change what happens early on. You know, when people can be released before they're found guilty of anything at this time that they're presumed innocent, they're in a much better position to fight the charges against them and make sure that they don't plead guilty to something they didn't do. And also their lives can continue, so you don't have the disruption to jobs and housing, and sometimes people lose their kids because they're in jail. Because all of those things affect black and brown people more than white people in this country, anything you do to heal the criminal justice system has this salutary effect in terms of racial justice. And that's not the only reason to care about it, but it's an important one.
Emily Bazelon's book is called Charged. You should go and get it. Jennifer Eberhard's book is called Bias. You should go and get it. They're going to, if you give them a second, they're going to exit that way. And I'd ask everyone else to exit this side, that side. And they'll be out signing their books.
Come talk
to us. Very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Crosscut Talks. This week's episode was recorded by Resty Bacall and produced by Sarah Bernard. Audio from the Crosscut Festival was recorded by Seattle Theater Group. You can subscribe to Crosscut Talks on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. For more on the Crosscut Talks podcast, go to crosscut.com/talks. And for the latest political, environmental, and culture news from the Pacific Northwest, visit crosscut.com. And just a reminder to save the date for the next Crosscut Festival, May 1st and 2nd, 2020. To learn more, go to crosscut.com/festival. Crosscut Talks is a product of Cascade Public Media. I'm Mark Bumgarten. We'll be back next week with another episode.